You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its new publications. If you have any suggestions on authors or books who you would love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Mariana Moglovich to talk about her book, The Invention of Public Space, Designing for Inclusion in Lindsay's New York. Hello, Mariana. Thank you for being here with us today.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for having me.
So, quick introduction. Mariana is the historian of architecture and urbanism and is the editor-in-chief of Urban Omnibus. Thank you again and welcome to the show. Before we begin, could you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. So as you said, I'm a historian of architecture and urbanism, and I feel like it's helpful to say I'm not an architect. I came into the field from originally an interest in film and photography and how we understand urban space. And after an experience working in an architecture firm, got really interested in the makings of the built environment themselves. And I've been really interested ever since in the interplay between the two, how the work of designers is understood out in the real world, and how in their work they understand the larger social forces that they're working in. So I went on to study the history of architecture and urbanism, and have taught both architecture students and liberal arts students, and currently edit a publication, Urban Omnibus, that looks at the making of the city from a vast number of disciplinary perspectives and across an expanded field of actors who really participate in the making of the city. So that's where I'm coming from.
Great. Thank you very much. And so with that, we'll just kind of dive right into the book. So first of all, you know, the idea of public space and even New York City are both very broad topics, but the book is pretty specific. And so, you know, focuses on Mayor Lindsay's New York City. And so we'll start with, you know, what makes that period worth examining over maybe some of the other mayors?
Sure. So I think a couple of different reasons. You know, one is certainly when I started this project and to this day, from the perspective of the form of the city and the state of architecture, it's pretty under considered. And in terms of the changing understandings of the city, who it's for, how it's meant to be made, was really a pretty important turning point, especially from the perspective of urbanism. People are, you know, very familiar at this point with the stories of Robert Moses and urban renewal and the post-war liberal interventions in city making that really sought to modernize the city, bringing in, you know, new concepts in architecture and planning, simultaneously destroying old neighborhoods and displacing, you know, large portions of the population. And that's a story that's well told and well known now, whether it's a celebration or a vilification or further reconsideration of, you know, the motivations and results of that period. And there's a little bit of a narrative of, okay, well, these things happened, and then we understood that urban renewal was bad, and that was kind of the end of that. And then things get a little hazy. But the period of Lindsay's administration, and he was elected mayor in 1965 and serves from 1966 to 1973, is a really critical turning point, both in terms of the fortunes and the politics of the city. You know, we start at the sort of, let's say, end of the high point, maybe, of the city's kind of post-war prominence, and come out of that period sort of mired in this moment of fiscal crisis, you know, and doubts about, you know, what is the future of the city? Is there one at all? In between, there's some really profound rethinking of the city, and specifically rethinking how the role of designers and how the city is shaped and who it's made for, that's really coming out of the backlash against urban renewal and the sort of sense of we need to do things differently, you know, both thinking about the human scale, paying attention to what people really want and need and are asking for, and finding a way for city government to help shape that development in a different practice. So it's a period, for a number of different reasons, really rich in experimentation. You know, Lindsay personally was interested in culture and design, and fairly unusually, I'd say, for a New York City mayor, an American mayor, really wanted to work with designers and let them experiment and try new things. And so so it's a really fertile period, and it's one where the kind of work that took place, the lessons were learned, were a little bit subtle, not so extraordinarily visible as you might look at an earlier period and say, behold Lincoln Center, you know, or behold Central Park. But they've been really, they're there, and they seeded a great deal of change in how we approach public space in the city. So that's a bit of a long answer for why I think this period is important. If I can just say, you know, one other piece of it, especially in this moment, the kinds of issues that they're grappling with, you know, the nature of democracy and planning and design and in the city are, you know, in some ways have not changed so much from that period, you know, grappling with these questions of participation, you know, who are designers meant to serve, dealing with really pressing questions of race and discrimination and inclusion. You know, a lot of the issues that that they're trying to deal with are pretty unresolved today.
I would agree. And it's an interesting point you bring up about, you know, this was a very experimental phase. And so I'll jump right to the end of the book and kind of give it away. You bring up the fact that a lot of these projects, and we can go into detail, had a lasting effect on kind of common design sense and common design principle. But a somewhat sad reality is not a lot of the physical spaces remain as of today.
Yeah, that's true. So I talk a little bit, I think, in the first chapter, you know, about what are the sort of spatial politics and practices of the administration, and what are the really lasting physical effects. And so, you know, the book is looking at open space, and the primary mode of experimentation really was in the city's open spaces. So parks, streets, residential plazas, post-industrial waterfronts. And this was about building, but also about much more ephemeral practices, you know, new arts happenings in parks. Even I talk a little bit about, you know, the mayor's own practices, you know, of this is the moment where Central Park first gets closed to car traffic for bike riding, right? So you have this idea of seeing folks and city officials, you know, out there on the streets, walking, bike riding. So some of it is not actually constructed. And in this moment of some urgency of doing things to demonstrate, you know, this is the city's a desirable place to live. It's a place that that is inclusive and that, you know, provides these kinds of amenities for everybody. One of the things about open space is, you know, it's pretty quick to throw an event in a park or even to put up, you know, a temporary playground in a Westpocket park in a way that doing something about the housing problem, doing something about the, you know, entrenched questions of racial inequality take a lot of time. Open space is somewhere where you can quite quickly make a demonstration that you're making an effort. So there's that piece of it that some of it is about the immediacy of that act and that gesture. And then there's a second piece of it that a lot of these projects are landscape projects. And landscape has a harder time being maintained and endured than putting up a library, let's say, or a school building. So I do, you know, kind of joke if I were to do a kind of walking tour of the landmarks of the projects that are discussed in the book, there wouldn't be a tremendous amount to look at this point. But at the same time, we would be able to, you know, see some sites and trace some of the related or kind of legacy sites connected to some of the projects that I look at.
Absolutely. And I'd like to talk about the Westpocket Parks. It was there's an entire chapter kind of dedicated to it. As I said, a lot of these principles have sort of moved forward to be part of the common design language, especially within urban environments. But Westpocket Parks in particular, you had mentioned it, that there was sort of this experimentation of kind of allowing the community to be much more involved. Whereas, before and even now, a common development strategy is somebody comes in and builds something and says, here it is for everyone to use. Whereas these pocket parks not only had the community weigh in on it, they even had some of the children test it. They even had some of the unemployed individuals of that area build it. So much, not to say that development isn't powerful, but these pocket parks seem to be one of the more powerful community catalysts, and the idea that open space really could spark further engagement from everybody.
For me, that's an important story. Also, I think important again in picking up a history that's really not well understood. When people think about pocket parks, you know, which are textbook example, right, of public space intervention, you know, the first thing that people will probably think about is Paley Park in Midtown Manhattan. And you frequently see it referred to as the first ever Westpocket Park, which, you know, just isn't true. And so understanding that these things didn't develop, you know, with the idea of a polished amenity for shoppers and workers in the central business district. But you know, the chapter on Westpocket Parks, it's I call it open spaces interface. And that idea of these small scale spaces and the projects of their construction as a kind of interface between between the city, between planners, the Parks Department, and residents and citizens was really powerful. So so there was this idea that it came from a few different strands, you know, that at this kind of small scale, and dealing with the vast number of vacant lots that you just had spreading across disinvested neighborhoods, you know, where buildings weren't being maintained, they were being demolished, and you had these dangerous eyesores. That at that scale, and you know, with sort of right, flexible, temporary design, you could really find a way for folks to work together with the city to really, you know, shape the spaces in their own neighborhood. So the idea was that these kinds of projects could really be a catalyst for larger transformations. And so, you know, I write about the first of a couple of these projects that were collaborations, actually not with the city itself, but with landscape architect Paul Friedberg and the Pratt Institute Center for Community Improvement, where, you know, as you said, it really came from a neighborhood initiative to inventory and catalog and look for improvements for all the vacant lots in the neighborhood, and then to work together, residents, the designer, students at Pratt, to build these into not just, you know, playgrounds for neighborhood kids, but in some cases, you know, neighborhood connectors, and again with this idea that these kind of small parks were the start of something bigger, not that it was so fabulous in and of itself to build a tiny park on a lot.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Absolutely. Great point. And so, you know, obviously we've been talking a lot about open space, and I will say one of the things that did bring me across this book was, just like most architects, you know, I had done a lot of reading on The Power Broker and Robert Moses. Mm-hmm. And to me, this book seemed almost like an unofficial sequel. Because the reality is, most people are aware of the thousands of parks and spaces that were built during that period. But then the question never really comes up, well, what happened after that? Mm-hmm. Especially because, as you put it, open, and you say it in the book, that open design is not simply a big open space. You know, especially, you know, the modernist architects had many of those high-rise towers with big open parks. But the sad reality is, those were not open spaces for the community to be used. I believe you say something that over 50,000 foot of chain link fence was ordered every year to kind of keep people from touching those green spaces. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could, you know, it's like, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
And so it's an interesting point. I was wondering if you could speak a little further on. The reality is that green open space is not anything new, but the experimentation of the open spaces, especially focused on in this book, are kind of a completely different animal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's about the function that these spaces are supposed to fulfill. So yeah, I think when you bring up the chain link fence question, the book starts looking at some interventions in the landscapes of the city's public housing development. So here you have the absolutely classic tower in the park, right, that has vast amounts of open space. It's been designed for a particular function, and that function is to provide light and air, right? It has a sort of public health function. And what you see, right, is that is not, that's not a human use, right? And so there's all kinds of conflict that develops as soon as these developments are finished, right? Where it's like, look, here's all this lawn, and it's literally got a keep out sign on it. So what does that tell residents about where they're living and their sort of claims on that space? What does that mean about, you know, what the spaces, you know, whether it's of the Jacob Riis houses or more broadly are meant to be for? So this idea of just use that I talk about, right, you know, about the functions of space and what are they to be used for, really shifts at this time. And there's really this emphasis on, well, it's not just about, you know, this sort of strictly functionalist, you know, people. And you talk about, you know, yes, that Robert Moses perspective of, you know, well, the masses need to be clothed and fed and housed and have access to air, right? That it's not just about you know, providing those kind of broad strokes necessities, but accounting for those kind of human and emotional and developmental needs that really get foregrounded at this moment, especially by designers working in open space, right? And it's coming from, you know, ideas in psychology that are popularized at the time, you know, about people need to have meaningful experiences. They need to feel, you know, secure in their spaces. Children, especially in their development, you know, need to have access to a range of different experiences and the ability to sort of control their actions and their spaces and their pathways through it. And these kind of small forms of agency in the environment, you know, might not be equivalent to, but at least stand for the idea of having a bigger say and degree of control over your life in the urban environment more generally. So there's really an emphasis, even when you look at some of the designs, like as I started in a way as a kind of model for the philosophy of this moment and many of the projects that come afterwards, Paul Friedberg's redesign of the Plaza of the Jacob Riis houses on the Lower East Side, right, from this kind of vast fenced in lawn that you can't use to this series of outdoor rooms and especially this adventure playground that's like nothing folks in the city or the country have really seen before, that it's all about that kind of free use, right? That people are not going to be told, you know, stay on this path, you know, sit here, do this, don't go there, but that it's kind of a terrain where you kind of have the agency to do what you want, including, you know, having fun. And so that's, you know, part of the spirit of the period too.
Absolutely. And you had mentioned the adventure parks, you know, which very simply put are much different. And I will say even today, even newer playgrounds still have that method of, you know, fixed play activity or toy was centered with kind of nothing around it. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of the interactive, you know, adventure park seemed novel then. It still seems novel now, but it's interesting because it was mentioned that that's somewhat of a North American thing. Whereas, you know, across the world, most countries do. And I believe it was in Finland, I believe, or Norway. They call them junk playgrounds for the literal idea of using salvaged materials to let children crawl all over and play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think one important thing first to mention that comes out of this, right, is that none of this stuff is sort of happening in a vacuum. And you brought up, well, you know, we think we understand the story of New York City and its built environment pretty well. And we do. And one of the things, because we think we know it so well, is tend to kind of see it a little bit hermetically and not, you know, as
absolutely
and shaping what's going on elsewhere. So, so there's this tradition of adventure playgrounds that actually start in Denmark and then are popularized in the UK after World War II as this idea that, you know, again, what can we do with these kind of, you know, bombed out lots? And one thing you can do is turn them into playgrounds. And there, it was really about, you know, again, not even the design, but the use. Like, you just have a lot of stuff. And a playground, right, you know, kind of watcher play coordinator, and kids would just build things themselves. Like, they'd literally be out there with, you know, hammers and rusty, you know, nails and building that. That would never fly in the US, even in this moment, right? So so the North American adaptation of the adventure playground, you know, is maintaining more in the kind of freedom of movement across the space and different kinds of experiences. And especially the sort of even modeling of this little microcosm of the city that kids can, you know, can scamper about and climb and sort of shape according to their imaginations, really explicitly a contrast, as you said, right, to that super functionalist, right, idea, again, of playground equipment, you know, that's all about here's your slide, here are your swings. you know, you hear the landscape architects at the period, right, really explicitly speaking against this idea of, you know, you have to go, you wait in line, it's your turn, you do the thing, you wait in line again. And so, you know, again, in contrast to that idea, you know, of the playground is microcosm of the city is the site of alienation, right? Where, like, all you can do is kind of go through these sterile environments and, like, do the basic things. You know, here are these great spaces where you can explore and move things around, right, and imagine different things, right? And yeah, you know, as you said, this is a case where a lot of those, for a number of different reasons, including, you know, our low tolerance for risk and litigious society, don't exist. Although some have been, you know, adapted and maintained, and it's, you know, there have been some impulses, I think, in more recent years to sort of bring those back in different ways. But it's still not what we tend to see when it comes to, you know, equipment for,
right, not
children's environments.
Absolutely. Well, and thank you very much for that. And so as we kind of come to a close, we've been talking very much about, you know, parks, whether they be big, small, and, you know, even playgrounds, which are kind of smaller parks. But, you know, they're kind of the reality of, you know, especially in New York City or any urban environment, a large kind of chunk of someone's outdoor activity or social interaction might not be happening in a dedicated green space. It might be happening on the street. Mm-hmm. And I know that you have an entire chapter kind of dedicated to the interaction on the street. And so I was wondering if you could kind of talk about a little bit how, because, you know, Lindsay and his administration didn't just focus on green space. They did spend some energy on the actual streetscape itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a super important part of this story. And I'll backtrack there a little bit to say, you know, I make this, you know, big and one could certainly debate claim about, you know, the idea of public space as a sort of concept being invented in this period. And part of that is moving from this very sort of typological idea of, you know, we have different kinds of spaces, right? Like, we have public parks and we have playgrounds and we have, mm-hmm, beaches, you know, and we have sidewalks, that all of these different spaces start coming under this sort of shared understanding and consideration as this thing called public space with you know, particular functions in the city at this time, so that it's not it's not a separate issue, right? To say, well, you know, we're going to like write a book about playgrounds, or we're going to write a book about streets, but it's really the whole continuum.
Absolutely.
And so the street is really, really fundamental in this period. And this is one where you can certainly say, well, you know, we can't see that now. And you can't see the results of what happened then, but you can certainly see them today and in the last 10 years in terms of a return to thinking about the street and the sidewalk, right? Not just as sort of vehicle pathway, but integration with plazas and you know, increasing pedestrianization, which was a big sort of incomplete project at the time. And so what you have, and that's kind of a complex story, is a number of different things sort of intersect, which are a growing environmental awareness and concern with air pollution, you know, which until quite recently in this moment hadn't even been associated with vehicles. You know, the issue was right. Industry. And that's, you know, completely connected to questions about the sort of future livability of the city, right? If you know, like the air is gross, what are we doing with these cars? You have, you know, issues of congestion and sort of speed of movement and desirability, you know, of office districts. And, you know, in the city's desire to redevelop, as I look at, you know, especially parts of West Midtown from industrial to office uses. And then you have the whole sort of political redefinition of the street in this period, right? When you're seeing so much protest activity, the street so much as a sort of place for people to be out, you know, together as citizens, together in solidarity, or making you know, claims against the state. So all of these things sort of come together in these funny ways, you know, to really kind of challenge what does the street mean in terms of urbanity and in terms of a kind of site where people act and feel themselves as citizens. So I sort of look at how the city kind of capitalized on this confluence of feelings and needs to try to reimagine, especially Midtown street networks as things, you know, that today would seem extremely familiar and best or ideal practices, pedestrianizing Midtown, Manhattan. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all right. It's funny you mentioned how things are familiar, you know, and I'm sure anyone listening to this didn't bat an eye at the idea that, you know, streets shouldn't just be for cars. People should also use streets. I'm sure that doesn't seem very novel now. Mm-hmm. You know, you actually talked about, you even show examples how is, you know, this book isn't written that long ago, but people were complaining when they closed the street because people were drinking coffee too close to a road, or teenagers were gathering where adults are. So, you know, we might think that's novel, but it's interesting to see that not too long ago, that was seen as this very foreign concept.
But yeah, it was seen as foreign and as threatening in part because a big piece of what all of these interventions are doing, right, is trying to expand the public of the city's public space. So again, coming back to that right. contrast with the earlier moment, as you said, you know, we might be familiar with all of these interventions, you know, that we associate with Robert Moses' new parks and playgrounds. And we have to remember that those were huge expansions of the public realm, but they weren't for everybody, right? And especially Absolutely. They weren't, you know, for the city's, you know, growing and excluded from so many trappings of citizenship, Black and Puerto Rican residents. And a big part of the lot of the Absolutely. Projects that we're looking at here in the 60s and 70s are about really expanding that public so that it's not just, you know, it's not just a white public. And beyond that, in this moment, you know, not just of demands by social movements, but also, you know, youth culture, the counterculture, challenging ideas of what kind of use and behavior are appropriate, right? So people might want to be, you know, more relaxed and do things that were not considered appropriate, you know, by a kind of more staid or conservative culture. So you see a lot of that clash. I think you're referring to one of my favorite pieces of research in this book is the city did all these experiments in temporarily closing streets on Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue with the idea right. that it would be made permanent. And this was a big deal. So you go to the archives and you just find volumes and volumes of letters that people personally wrote to the mayor, you know, either to be like, mm-hmm. thank you, this is so incredible, all caught up in this kind of language and thinking about what that means for like their understanding of how the city lets them be free and how they're citizens and what kind of power the people have, and the people complaining. And a big piece right. of those complaints are seeing, you know, long-haired, disrespectful hippie youth, you know, out on the street, like that's appropriate, or what at this time ultimately shuts down in part plans for more permanent street closings are businesses, right, who are really worried about the quote unquote, you know, wrong element, you know, taking over the street and scaring off, you know, the more affluent or normative buyers. So, so there's both this right. kind of sense of here are these, you know, spaces for community and for people to go together, to be together, but also a lot of fear and anger and hatred and contestation about, you know, whose streets are they, you know, and what kind of behavior is appropriate and who has a right to be present.
Absolutely. And it could be an entire podcast between you guys separately that there's quite a bit of parallel between that and kind of what's been going on this year. So whether it was accidental at the timing of reading it was very interesting on that.
Yeah, it's you know, it's funny because these projects take you know, take forever, and so it was both impossible to predict neither when the book itself was actually being completed a year ago or when I started this project much earlier that we'd right. be where we are at the moment that it comes out, and at the same time not surprising in that, you know, we're talking about a whole bunch of questions that are still entirely unresolved. So I think, you know, we've been seeing again both the kind of
absolutely,
you know, power that these spaces have in terms of people's ability to you know, gather protests and really, you know, contest claims to who's the city built for, you know, whose rights are important. And also I think similarly in this moment, you know, between the kind of efflorescence of the Black Lives Matter movement, but also COVID, you know, mm-hmm. concerns again about the desirability Absolutely. Of city living and density and what kind of, you know, the kind of rush to make interventions to, again, you know, have sidewalk cafes, get people out and dining and those kind of strategies that are, you know, out of this sense of urgency to make plain the desirability and sort of affability of urban living. So there are many, many very direct parallels, and yet, of course, it's a different historical moment. But not for that, I think, are there not a lot of lessons that are still to be learned from this earlier moment, so that we don't sort of repeat the same pattern again?
Absolutely. And so again, I want to thank you again for speaking with me. As I said, the book is The Invention of Public Space. And so before we go, I was wondering, you know, as you had said, you know, this project kind of wrapped up a little while ago. So what have you been kind of keeping yourself busy with since then amidst all this chaos?
Well, a couple of things. You know, one is always keeping my eye on the contemporary state of city making in New York and urban omnibus. And then the second, which is, you know, slow moving, is, you know, as often happens with these projects, what for me is, you know, we didn't talk about the last chapter of the book, which is really sort of shifting to the scale of environment and what does it mean to sort of start thinking That's about right. reoccupying and remediating, you know, the city's waterfronts in these post-industrial environments. And there are some really, really interesting projects at that time, you know, again, trying to both combine environmental remediation, looking at polluted water, at disused land, and providing access to and new kinds of access to open space. And so for me, all of those environmental questions have really opened up a kind of next and new avenue of research, really looking at that sort of larger scale of environments that similarly, you know, sort of draw us together in mutually intertwined fates and what it means to design those. So I've been increasingly interested in those questions of the sort of intersection of city making and remediation and a larger project looking at the intersections of the production of waste and the production of space in the metropolitan environment. So sort of moving further up in scale and across time is where things are headed.
Very interesting. I can't wait to read or see what's next.
Me neither. It'll
thank
be
you
a while.
Again for speaking with me.
Thank you. This was really a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure's all mine. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you and have a great day.